Good morning, everybody. I am reopening our deliberations on insurance. We're going to talk about a paper on financial instruments with discretionary participation features, and I give the floor to Joan for the TL.
Good morning. Right. Yes, financial instruments with discretionary participation features. These are investment contracts that do not transfer any insurance risk. So they're not insurance contracts, but they're otherwise very similar to other investment contracts that insurers issue that do have life insurance with them. They're managed together with insurance contracts and often share in the performance of the same pool of assets. They are overwhelmingly issued by insurers, and they're very common in some jurisdictions, but relatively uncommon in others. And we're going to consider two questions today. The first one is what the applicable standard should be for these instruments, whether they should be included in the scope of the insurance contract standard or not. And if they're not, they would by default be within the scope of the general financial instruments standards. The second question, which is in paper 14C, is to consider if you do include these instruments within the scope of the insurance contract standard, how they should be defined. But if we start with the applicable standard, the IASB and the FASB are going to be discussing these questions separately. And that's because we have different factors to consider. The instruments aren't common in the US, and there is no accounting requirements for them at present. Jennifer has kindly come along to answer any questions you might have on where the FASB might be going on this matter. Paper 14A is a background paper, and it sets out the nature of these instruments and how the project has gone so far. In the IASB exposure draft proposed to include these instruments in the scope of the insurance contract standard, whereas the FASB discussion paper proposed to exclude them. The feedback that we got was that most US insurers supported FASB proposal, but most respondents in other categories supported the IASB proposals. And that included the non-US insurers, regulators, actuaries, the owners who are commenting. The big four accounting firms were split in their views. Two of them wanted to include these instruments in the scope of the insurance contract standard. The other two said they would prefer to see them in the financial instruments standards, but only if and when the board has amended the FI standards so that they better address discretionary participation features. Paper 14B is the first one that asks you a question. It considers the arguments for and against including these instruments in the scope of the insurance standard. Paragraph 11 talks about comparability. Paragraph 13 mentions complexity. Paragraph 17 onwards talk about the difficulties that could arise if we had to apply the FI standards. And paragraph 26 discusses how supporters of the proposal to include them in the insurance standard frequently commented that it gives more meaningful information to users about it. And the staff conclusion and recommendation is that from an IFRS perspective, it'd be better to include these instruments in the scope of the insurance contract standard. The question for you is, do you agree?
Well, I must say, pretty amazing products. But and do they still survive in these modern times?
Well, you have to have a lot of faith. I open the floor. We go.
No, I not agree for the following reasons. First, you know, we clearly say there's no insurance risk, or no significant insurance risk. And this is one of the fundamental reasons why many people oppose us, our position, And secondly, from beginning, why we want to put such kind of product into insurance? Number one reason we said, you know, quite often the case, the asset pools were mingled with others. And I personally not agree with such kind of, you know, argument. Firstly, you know, mingle or non-mingle is really depend on a country's regulatory framework and the practice. And in some jurisdictions, as I understand in Europe, maybe mingle together is common, but in other regions not. And the staff also mentioned in the paper some of the even European nations and non-mingle, the regulatory not require, not allow you to do so. And so this is not sound basis. And interestingly, staff asked second questions and proposed to eliminate the conditions into original definition. And means we will require more products, even not have mingled the pools separate to such a standards. I feel the confused by why. At the same time, we said this is the fundamental reasons why propose to account for insurance standards, but at the same time, we want to eliminate such a condition. Maybe staff can explain to me. And certainly, staff just said, you know, FSB will not discuss with us. It's because, you know, the environment is different. But my question is, we are setting international standards. And if other jurisdictions also said our environment is not similar to the environment you described, but rather much closer to U.S. environment, then how we protect ourselves, our argument? And lastly, as Tom mentioned, that, you know, if we use financial instrument standard, then we'll face lots of troubles. And of course, there are some problems. And but, you know, whether in all jurisdictions, those troubles mentioned in the paper will all have such kind of problems or not, I don't think so. Because in many jurisdictions, products are not so complicated as you described. And secondly, even we have problems of liability equity, but maybe in such an environment, maybe constituency will accept non-recognized liability. As equity, they have no problem. So, of course, it is debatable whether construction obligation should be recognized as liability, but we should not, you know, clearly say it, since we are not able to solve in financial instrument standards, and we are able to solve in insurance standards, then we put into insurance standards. But as I understand, even the American colleagues will not favor our position on construction obligations. So in conclusion, I'm not favor.
Pat?
I have a couple of questions. The first question speaks to the observation that you make in paper 14A, I think is the most critical issue here in terms of making a practical decision. It's in paragraph 12. It says the main issue is whether the additional benefits should be classified as liabilities or a more unusual form of equity. And I guess my question is, from a practical standpoint, would the participation feature, if let's say we decided these should be accounted for as financial instruments, would the participation feature always be deemed to be a derivative and as a result accounted for as a liability, or would it be accounted for as equity? I guess that's one of my questions. I guess the second question is, if these contracts are sold with an expectation that the insurance company is going to share with the customer, the policyholder, a certain amount of the earnings, is there incumbent upon the insurer essentially to make clear what its intention is in terms of, you know, the amount of obligation it plans to pay out? Is there a constructive obligation, if you will? Or can they be completely silent and, you know, one period pay zero, another period pay 100%? You know, is there some sort of constructive obligation when the contract is silent as to the amount of payout?
Does the staff want to get in here?
Yeah. Right. First one, I think it's very important, as you say, to look at the various pieces within the contract.
Mm-hmm.
So you talked about derivatives, you talked about liabilities. I'd rather start by, when you look at these things, you need to do a very thorough analysis of which bits you're looking at. And in most of the contracts, what you have is a situation where you guarantee a minimum return, normally very low or reasonably low, and then you say, I will give you a certain percentage of the return on the pool of assets. And that is not up for discussion. I'll give it to you anyway. The only thing I can change is the timing where I'll give it to you. So I cannot change the amount. I can only change the timing. So that will meet the definition of a financial liability if you apply the FI standards. And then there's another piece to this puzzle. And the piece to this puzzle is I, at my discretion, can pay you an additional amount, which I will define. It's not written anywhere. I can say out of my, say, 20%, I can give you an additional 5 for different reasons, for market reasons, because I want to keep my base of policyholders, etc. That bit is the one that causes the problem, because on that bit, you have a discretion both on timing and amount. And if you apply the FI standards, that would need to go through IAS 32 and most likely will meet the definition of an unusual form of equity. Then if you take one step further, you ask the question, how do people manage these things? What they do is they look at this as a long-term expected payout rate. And they say, at any point in time, based on the facts and circumstances that I know, I will estimate how much is the payout under this DPF. And if you apply 32, it becomes very difficult because you have something that is managed on an expected payout basis, while under IS 32, what you have is a locked amount that you can't change. So, in essence, what you will be doing is you will be reclassifying out of your retained earnings once you declare it. So that's the framework for your first question. How would you go about classifying these things within the scope of financial liabilities and equity under the FI standards? So, in essence, what we're trying to say is if you go for this route, you will first create something that is inconsistent with the way people manage it in real life. Secondly, the FI standards, as John mentioned, are not fit for this purpose. So you will need, John, you will need to change the FI standards to make it work. On the way you share it, and that's more on your second question, there's not much clarity, actually. From the ones I've seen, there's not much clarity. The clauses are reasonably vague. There are some regulatory constraints, as Weigo also mentioned, for some products where you will have to pay out a certain amount. You have discretion on the timing. But on the ones that are purely discretionary, there's not much really. And you can actually walk away without paying anything at your own discretion. In a nutshell, the ones that you have discretion on the timing, if you really go for applying the FI standards, it becomes a measurement problem, in essence. The ones that have discretion and the bit on the discretion, that is the one that causes the problem because you will have to componentize. And once you open that box, then you create a whole raft of problems. Because let's say you have a situation where you start with a closed group of policyholders. So you define who's the population at the beginning, and all the lapse rates, so the guys who choose to walk away and take the surrender value, that amount accrues to the shareholder. So any new policyholders will not have any kind of benefit on that. I will take it as a shareholder.
So just to come back very briefly on the first part, you said under
finish your.
I'm about to. But
okay, I'm sorry.
Let them just finish.
So in essence, this is just a simple example where, let's say, you have this closed pool of policyholders, and some of them decide to go, and you have your expectation about the lapse rate. If you apply the FI standards to the bit that is fully discretionary, how do you treat it?
Sure.
Yeah. How do you treat obligations that come out of the goodness of your heart?
Right.
Yeah.
And that's basically what we're talking about.
Yeah, that's the thing.
I guess the way I was also thinking about looking at this based on our previous discussions is that if you looked at the discretionary participation feature essentially as a call option on the earnings of the company, that effectively if you have complete discretion, the strike price is zero, right?
True.
So if you set that strike price as something north of that, then you would accrue a liability. So couldn't you essentially say that this should always be classified as a liability, and it's just a question of the measurement of the amount?
No, because
why?
If you can avoid the delivery of cash and the 32, it will be an equity instrument. It's avoidable. The problem is 32, as it stands, it's based on the right that you have to avoid the delivery of cash, and that's what causes the problem.
For me to understand properly, if you have discretion over the timing of the payment,
there's no way you can avoid liability.
Okay, but does that mean you can wait till a time that where the profit that you made or the return on profit on the investment that you made is gone? Does that mean that also?
In theory, you can. It will affect them. It becomes a measurement issue. The problem is you have some kind of regulatory constraints around this, normally, where the regulator will say, for example, in some products I've seen, you have to pay every 5 years, 10 years.
Okay.
But in theory, you can. But
so if you just issued a call option with similar features, okay, would you classify that as a liability or an equity instrument?
If you can avoid the delivery of cash, it's equity.
Daryl.
Seems to me that we've got a problem here that we sort of stuck with the past decisions we've taken. So we have a particular treatment for insurance DPFs. We've got particular treatments for FI. We already know that FI, as I think you've put out, doesn't really cover the situation particularly well. But also these instruments haven't really been tested against FI terribly often. I've got some sympathy with what Wago said, but in the end what you've ended up with is having taken the decision on insurance DPFs, knowing that the FI decisions we've historically taken don't handle these instruments particularly well, we're now talking about dealing with an instrument that looks in most material aspects identical to an insurance DPF, that will most often or very frequently be carried on the same balance sheet as an insurance DPF. And we're then talking about whether or not you would want to treat this instrument that looks the same and is managed on the same balance sheet, managed the same way, whether it's warranted to treat this instrument differently. And to my mind, that's kind of the important question here. We may touch on whether or not the actual insurance DPF decision is perfect but at the end of the day, we're looking at two practically identical instruments and asking whether or not they should be measured the same. And as much as I've got sympathy with what you're saying, it seems to me that two very similar instruments should be treated the same.
Yeah, that's my view as well.
As Daryl mentioned, you know, the environment, you know, insurance companies, banks, security firms may offer similar products. They may call different names, but in nature they are the same. And as Daryl said, you know, traditionally bank will never think about they should apply insurance standards in their products or others companies. Maybe insurance companies, because they're insurance company, they will think, should use insurance standards. So as Daryl said, maybe we should take test, you know.
What was your last sentence?
We should test.
Test.
Test what?
Test.
The FI standards. In banks and the security firms, they never think about logic. We are thinking for insurance standards.
But I thought Ron's expose was rather convincing how problematic that becomes.
Yeah.
John.
I agree with Daryl that two instruments that are the same ought to be treated the same. But I agree with Wago, it ought to be a liability and treated under financial instruments, not under insurance. The difficulty that we had a long time ago when we discussed this was, is it a liability, is it not? And I think the board kind of ducked answering the question because of all the variations. And we also kind of ducked making a decision on it with the idea that we were working on 32 financial instruments, and we parked this thing. But the reason I don't like this at all is it expands the insurance model. And what this says essentially is take this instrument that's got 30 years, I get to decide how much I'm going to pay over 30 years, or if I'm going to pay. There's just a lot of discretion I have in recognizing this as part of that model. It also seems to me that this meets the definition of a financial instrument, or I'd say it the other way, it meets the definition of a financial instrument without insurance, and we're going to put this in there somehow. And so all of a sudden we have that in there. If we weren't thinking about this project and a bank issued one of these things, we'd say, is there an obligation or not? And I would agree if you have an obligation but discretion over the timing, you have an obligation. But the point on the discretion is if I can pay today or in 30 years, that number is hugely different depending on when I think I'm going to pay the thing. And in 30 years, it's probably very small. So I look at that and I start thinking of your responses on 32, I don't think I'd answer them the same way, by the way. One thing we didn't do in this whole discussion was have a proper analysis of 32. And I think if we evaluated this from the perspective of a bank issued this thing, it's going to pay principal and interest at some point in time, and it's got discretion to pay more, you wouldn't even account for it. I don't think it would go into equity at inception because there's nothing there. No part of it is the holder entitled to or the bank has to pay, even in liquidation. So we haven't had a proper analysis of 32. It would seem to me if a bank did this, you'd record it at the amount you received. We say you recorded fair value, but this would be a level 3. Level 3 wouldn't let a bank take a gain on the thing. And so it would be stuck with the amount it recorded it at. But again, when I get down to it, I think it's a financial instrument. I don't think we should expand the model for this, make another exception for insurance. And nothing's changed from the alternative view that you've already got in the paper.
So, Sue wants to get in. Sue, first.
Yeah. Well, the staff thinks I've done a proper analysis of 32.
What paper did? What was that in?
As a background to this paper. I guess on your point, you may well have a situation where the amount that would be attributed to this equity-like component would be small or nothing. But I think the issue that Xiao was highlighting is the fact that because there is an equity component that under 32, you're not then able to remeasure for the effects of your changes and what your expectations are in terms of what's going to be distributed. So, and that creates this disconnect between how the instrument gets managed and how it gets measured under 32. And I guess I'm with you in the sense that it's always nice to have the same literature applied to similar products, if you like. But I guess my only concern, if we do decide to go into FI, is that I think we're pretty quickly going to go headlong into the whole economic compulsion debate under IAS 32, which has been such a difficult topic for us in the past.
I don't agree this would be an equity component under 32, because I don't see something that you would componentize when there's no obligation at all. we can have that debate. I'd like to have a paper on it. That said, I don't like expanding this model at all in such a way that a bank could issue one of these things and all of a sudden it's under insurance accounting. And then the bank says, I'll get to decide when I'm going to make this payment. And it what does it do? It calls it all financial obligations. And it'd be hard to tell it's under insurance. Nor would, I think, a typical analyst looking at a bank statement understand or want to understand that, gee, why does that make sense for a bank? I would rather, as much as I hate saying this, I would rather try to find a way that if you have this feature and most of your obligations or some significant amount of your obligations is insurance, you can treat it as insurance and you get to do this estimation and all that. But if not, and someone else were to issue this, you apply financial instruments. But, you know, it's on the fly. It's not something that's been recommended. So for now, I don't agree with staff.
Stephen?
So, John, let's assume that the 32 problem is resolved and it is a financial liability. So what I'd like to know is how you would then think it would be accounted for under financial instruments. Is this amortized cost or fair value?
Well, right now, under 9, it would qualify for amortized cost, I believe, because assuming I went through a proper evaluation, concluded I don't have an obligation here, then there's no derivative. And then under 39 or 9, you would account for it when you declared it, just like a dividend. And you would expense it, I believe.
But how is that going to be useful information, given that the underlying assets probably going to be at fair value? And the participation feature is to participate in the performance of those underlying assets. Aren't you just going to create an accounting mismatch?
Well, one, I don't believe you have to have a corresponding asset the way this is defined. You could. But what you're really asking is, what are we going to do about accounting mismatches generally? We have them. I don't think it's our resolve to get them all matched up so that we don't see any volatility. And it also seems to me that if I have discretion and I could pay you between now and 30 years, that volatility ought to be shown because I have the right not to pay you. I get to keep whatever the value is of the asset if, in fact, I have an asset. The other thing I would on this particular one, I'd try to fit it under 32 and maybe look at that, see if there was some way to do that, and provide some guidance there, or more guidance than if to the extent that there's confusion now. But I wouldn't want to expand the model.
Could I ask a question? It's an assertion that John's making, and that is, if these products are sold with the expectation that, in fact, you're going to share, okay, then do you really have that complete discretion not to pay for 30 years? In other words, would a regulator ultimately come in and say, you have a constructive obligation and you really need to start paying out these earnings at a certain level? Yeah, forget about the economic compulsion part. I'm thinking more from a regulatory, contractual, because you made a contract with the policy.
I think, feel free to chip in if you like, Sue. But my view on that is, you cannot split economic compulsion from this debate, and the reason why is because let's say you have total discretion to avoid it, and the regulator wouldn't bother with it, which I doubt because they do bother.
Yeah, exactly.
But let's say in theory that you have total discretion to avoid the payment for 30 years, and all your competitors are paying a certain percentage. Inevitably, you are economically compulsed to pay. There's no way out, because otherwise your policyholders will just walk away.
Why bother sell the contract in the first place if you
Yeah, why bother getting into that logic in the first place?
Where does that lead you?
It leads me to treat it as a liability.
So you should do the same with preferred stock dividends, because they're absolutely economically compelled to pay them.
Well, see,
if they don't, the stock could go down big time.
Yeah.
Where do you stop with this market?
There, because we've defined preferred stock as an equity instrument,
I would say that. I would leave it in equity.
So economic compulsion is not good in one sense, it's okay in another.
And that's my concern. Where on earth do you draw the line? Because if I buy a blue chip ordinary share, my expectation is they're always going to pay an ordinary dividend, but we don't account for it that way.
Yeah. Only if it's been declared by the board of directors.
No,
and
but
set.
The expectation is, and the compulsion, the pressure from the market is.
But you're absolutely right. And actually, credit analysts actually treat common stock dividends as a fixed charge for that reason.
Tom Scott.
Amaru. Sorry, Peter, yes.
I think if you wanted to go down the constructive obligation route, it would be extraordinarily difficult to know where to draw the line. And let me give you an example from the UK. In the UK with profits funds, what happens is if they make a distribution, 90% goes to policyholders, 10% is available to the shareholders. But contractually, they're not required to pay anything at all. Theoretically, they could keep it in the fund indefinitely. In practice, of course, that doesn't happen. Over the last 5 to 10 years, the regulator got quite unhappy about the amount of discretion that was available to this and required the insurers to start spelling out publicly in more detail how they intended to exercise their discretion. So there's no doubt that over that period, wherever the line is, it's probably moved a bit to the right, but it's not sure where it was to start with. It's not really that clear where it was to end with. If we force people to make that line, they don't know how much of what they're paying is because they've got a constructive obligation to do it, how much of it is because of economic compulsion. It would just be a minefield to try and draw that line.
Absolutely.
Amaru?
Thank you, Hans. What puzzles me a little bit in the discussion is the reasoning under IFRS 4. The reasoning on IFRS 4 was that this was a temporary alternative for this sort of instruments. Why? Because they were identified as mainly issued by insurers. So in this point, I agree with John. We are, although developing a standard for the insurance contracts, keeping or deciding or discussing to keep an exception, an additional exception that is not related to the insurance contract itself directly, and the paper clearly states that they have no insurance risk. So this is the question that I'm trying to respond to myself. And then it comes to IAS 32. I think we failed during the whole period between the issuance of IFRS 4 and the discussion in the FICE project to come up with a clear answer. So, but this brings me another issue. There might be a number of contracts, a myriad of financial instruments contracts out there that we are silent today, that we do not provide any guidance at all, and do refer this to the users of IFRS to apply IAS 32 at their discretion at the end of the day. Why? Because the only question that came to the board up to now on IAS 32 was economic compulsion back in 2006, and the board decided to be silent, or at least understood economic compulsion should not be considered when classifying between equity and liability. Then, to my mind, I would prefer having any sort of instrument or any sort of financial instruments under one standard, the financial instrument standard. I think we are perpetuating a temporary decision that was taken back when the board decided to IFRS 4. I have this sort of concerns that Steve expressed on volatility and mismatch, but at the end of the day, I think John is correctly stated, there are lots of volatilities and mismatches in our model today in many other industries. And then comes to my mind that, of course, banks, those are the ones that I think, firstly, as issuing similar instruments. I guess there are many similar instruments in the banking industry that share characteristics of DPFs. And also potentially corporates. I don't know every jurisdiction. So I think we ought to be very clear in our decision here. Why are we perpetuating this? Because we are not going to put these instruments under the FI, and we should be aware that if we do not do this now, this will be a decision that will be applied for a long period of time. So, although understanding the complexities and the issues that were brought by the staff, I do not support in keeping this exception to one industry, and of course bringing this exception to all other industries that issue an instrument, a financial instrument, and include in the financial instrument maybe characteristics of DPFs, and because we were unable to respond under the FI.
Philippe?
Well, I'm not going to repeat all what has been said by my colleagues, starting from the left. I think if I was convinced that those instruments are issued only by insurance companies, I would not have a problem to bring them on the balance sheet and measuring them similarly to other things which have a little bit of insurance component. But given the definition which is expressed in paper 14C, paragraph 3, I think that definition could apply to many instruments issued by non-insurance entities, banks and corporates. Think of a tracker share which tracks the performance of a department within an entity, shares in the profit or loss of that department as a minimum guaranteed component. And there is a contractual right for the holder to participate in the profit, and there is discretion on the timing of payment. I think that could fall under the definition, and we had exchanges with Joao on that, and it could be captured by the definition in 14C. Hence, we would attract into the insurance standard products which potentially are issued by non-insurance entities. And I could be convinced that they are a bit different, but I have not seen a paper yet analyzing those differences between something which would fall here and would be slightly different. So before we decide to attract into the insurance standard a lot of products which could be very, very close to those ones, I would be sure that we manage all the consequences in terms of measurement, presentation, using OCI, etc., etc., etc. So at this stage, I'm not convinced.
Can I just say something?
Yeah.
I think it's probably worthwhile spending 1 or 2 minutes discussing a couple of issues that I think are important. Today, these instruments are within the scope of IFRS 4. So we specifically said these instruments are treated by IFRS 4. The implication of that is that people treated them under their statutory gap. So that's the consequence of that. I would also like to highlight two things that came out of the feedback process. The first one was the feedback from the Big Four, where they said, two of them said insurance standard, consistent with the way these products are managed, in my view. And the other two said FI, but until you fix FI, you need to keep them in the insurance standard because FI standards have not been designed to deal with these products. Then the question is, do we want to leave FI untouched on this specific matter or not? And the other question is, because presumably with this model we're going to withdraw IFRS 4, we can't be silent. We have to say what we're going to do in relation to these instruments, because we've already said what people should do today in relation to DPFs. And I just wanted to highlight this just to...
In other words, should we decide not to leave this in the insurance standard, we will have to face the consequences that we need to fix FI,
yeah.
And that will take a lot of time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we could also decide to leave them in the insurance standard for now and decide to fix FI at a later date, of course.
That's another solution. Yeah.
That would be another solution so that we don't stall the insurance project.
I think you could find a way to limit this to insurance companies. That would be one.
Okay. I'm sorry.
I don't think you automatically...
First, you said we could limit this option
that would
to,
be one way
to
how to
insurance
limit it
companies only, so within the insurance standard.
And I know we're not doing insurance industry, but I think you could find a way to limit it to those entities that issue primarily insurance contracts. And granted, I'm doing this on the fly. So that's
Ian wants to get in.
Yeah, John, I mean, thanks to Philippe, I've had a look at paper 14C again. And paragraph 3, that last bit which people objected to in the exposure draft, I read, but that would limit it to if there were insurance contracts as well, which effectively, I think, would limit it to the insurance industry.
That would be another way.
Yes, the bit at the bottom.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question about the definition of details.
But my point was, I think there's, we got this all. If we don't do this now, we've got a real big problem. I think there's other ways to attack this problem. And one of the other things, if we were to exclude this from insurance, I'd identify what are the problems with 32, and I would bet you that we could tweak that or make it very clear. We could expand IFRIC, give them something to do, and provide an interpretation. I just don't think it's as black and white as this is going to be really bad.
Okay, but this is very different from saying, no way we're going to allow this in the insurance standard. What you're proposing now is, yes, we can allow it, but restrict it to the insurance industry if we can fix it that way. It's a very different answer than saying out flat, we're going to refuse to do it, knowing full well that we are then have to face the consequences of having to fix financial instruments, and we know that would take a lot of time because this is not a very simple issue to resolve. PK.
Thank you. I think I'm having real difficulty in this situation for two reasons. One is that my heart says that, you know, fix it as soon as possible somewhere, because that way at least you'll address the need. And the mind says, no, stick to financial instruments because that's the right solution. Somewhat jocularly, is that what would be the title of this standard? It's no more insurance contracts. We got to change the title so that to draw the attention. So that's one thing I thought about. And also, we have evolved. That's Deloitte. It looks like it's more to facilitate a particular industry that doesn't go down well with our principles-based and our evolved theory of principles-based accounting. But keeping those aside for a second, I was just thinking, okay, let's put this in the insurance standard. Okay, let's not say these are financial instruments. So then what are the knock-on effects? The knock-on effects that I would be thinking about is that perhaps one is the own credit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Second one is deposit floor.
True.
That's another one which would be breaching or changing that, and potentially you will be going below the deposit floor. And don't bite me on this one. Are we bringing back shadow accounting in some sense?
That's a different thing.
But are we kind of somehow bringing back the shadow accounting?
Let me clarify that shadow accounting thing.
The king of that.
The reason why you do shadow accounting under IFRS 4 today is to make sure your P&L, OCI type thing, is actually correctly split between the policyholder and the shareholder. Because if you say, I'm going to pay out, and let's take a very straightforward example. You invest $1,000 in a pool of assets on day one. Next year, the value of those assets is $1,200. And for argument's sake, let's assume they're all equities to not create any kind of problems with recycling through profit or loss. So you have 200 sitting on your OCI reserve. And let's assume that it's the only thing you're going to look at. And you have an 80-20 split. 80 is to the policyholder, 20 is to the shareholder. If you do nothing, you would be overstating your total equity. So the thing that shadow accounting does is to take out that 80 and say, this is not something that belongs to the shareholder. And it belongs to the policyholder.
Yeah, I agree.
Make sure that is right. So to
no,
make clear
no,
what,
I completely
what
agree. I completely agree and I follow that. My only point is that is discretionary. And I go back to, I will ignore the economic compulsion for a second and go back to para 15 of IAS 32.
Yeah.
And the thing that para 15 says in the end is that not only you should account it, but you should also meet the definition of a financial liability, financial asset, and an equity.
Yeah.
Now, how will we not, I know there is some argument whether this is even 32, but I feel that there is an equity component somewhere lurking here. And so I just have difficulty to overcome that unless we, I honestly, like I said, own credit, deposit for those things are there. But I'm willing to change this to the insurance industry and put it in IFRS. But what will you do with 32? Do we need to do a consequential amendment to 32 to say, except for DPF, which is dealt in such and such place? How will we do that? But we just need to, the problem with 32 is that there is no basis of conclusion. And people like me who have not participated in the standard setting, it's very difficult to follow 32 because it's not, there's no basis of conclusion here. And somewhere we need to put it because otherwise it just doesn't jive. How do you get there?
Can you unlock it?
If you wanted to put it, if the decision were to put it in the insurance contract standard and not in 32.
Not my first preference, but...
No, but should that be the way that the vote goes, then you would just have it in the scope section, so it would be in the...
As it is already.
As it is already. So you would see in the scope of insurance contract standard as drafted in the ED that the standard applies to these financial instruments, just like insurance contracts are really financial instruments. It applies to two types of financial instruments. And in 32, you've already got the exception that takes them out of 32 and IFRS 9 and 39, so it's the same scope across the three standards, and excludes them already.
I see, because the scope takes care of it, you don't need to do in the para 15.
You don't even read the standard, because you've already been excluded from the scope.
Paul.
Good point.
I support the staff recommendation to include these contracts in insurance contracts. Standard. I'm not troubled that they also meet the definition of financial instrument and therefore should be under IFRS 9. We have loads of financial instruments that we've scoped out of IFRS 9. Everything, for example, an investment in a subsidiary, associate, joint venture, leases, pension funds, and insurance contracts. They're all financial instruments, but we've decided to look at the economic characteristics of the instrument and decide the accounting based on the economic characteristics. These contracts with discretionary participation features are managed like insurance contracts. They're similar to insurance contracts, and I think they should be accounted for the same way. So I support the staff recommendation.
Tuck?
Hans, can I come in at some point?
Yes, Dad. Yeah. Go on.
I'll keep it brief. Like Paul, I also support staff recommendation to keep these within the insurance contract. Yes, I recognize that they are financial instruments, but I don't think that the financial instrument standard is adequate to account for these on a reasonable basis that would provide users with useful information. I think treating these under amortized cost is totally inappropriate and would provide information that is just not useful.
Doc?
Yes.
Thank you, Pat.
I discussed this issue with lots of friends in Japan. And I think this issue is largely depend on each jurisdiction and also largely depends on the regulation of each country. But in Japan, the opinion was totally split. And some people say it should be in the insurance contract. And some people say, no, it's definitely the financial instruments. And my conclusion is support staff's recommendation. But provided only that there is a condition, it must be limited to insurance industry, as we discussed. I don't know. I don't think it's a good way to limit the industry. This is not what the IFRS is doing. But for this particular issue, the reason why we cannot help leaving it in the insurance accounting standard is only because current practice is largely depend on the largely in the insurance accounting standard. So therefore, the thing we have to tackle is we have to develop this issue in the financial instrument, but it may take longer. So then I would support staff's proposal, but condition is it should be limited to insurance industry.
Do the staff consider that feasible?
I think it's feasible. It's something that you previously decided that you didn't want to create an industry standard, but it can be done. You just say somehow. We could discuss that further in when we're discussing the definition. But
can I just say one point there on that point?
One thing the staff, if we are not going to vote on fly and you're going to come back on this, one thing you might want to think about is that in a consolidated situation where it's a bank and an insurance company, how would it look is something we need to think about, because it doesn't feel good going back to the comment that like instruments should be treated like. That it will have some unsavory thing with, especially somebody breaching the deposit floor and somebody having own credit problems. So it looks a little bit silly. So think about it. I'm not against it, but I just want to address that. How do we deal in that situation? Then in that situation, should we give it to the consolidated entity? My answer is yes.
Paul? Actually, the next paper before us, paper C, proposes a way to restrict it to the insurance industry. I support the staff answer in paper C also. But I mean, that would be the issue in paper C is it says you can only get these into insurance contracts if the funds are pooled with insured funds, with contracts that insurance contracts. But I think the arguments against that are persuade me not to to do that. But that is one way that we could resolve tax.
Way go.
Where am I on? I'm for treating them as insurance contracts and not adding the restriction that the funds be pooled.
Way go.
The first, I want to clarify some of the concerns from the audience, or the other sub and board members, and my views on if we want to put into insurance standards, you know, what kind of way we should put into insurance standards. And firstly, you know, I and some others already mentioned the features of such products mainly depend on the regulatory framework and the company practice. And Peter also mentioned that in UK, and recently, the regulators, you know, apply strict requirements on the distribution. And similar what John said, you know, from the issuer's point of view, sometimes there was few, you know, if those distributions which in line with regulatory requirements and also in line with companies, you know, declare the policy, they will feel this kind of the liability, this kind of obligation is not contracting liability, but as a contractual or legal liability. So the debate we have on the whether constructive or, you know, the contractual liabilities, the lines are not as clear as we think about. And secondly, the Steve mentioned about, you know, mismatch. As I understand, not always the case. The asset side will be favorable at all. It really depends on the products you provide to the market and the prospectus you have specified. What, you know, it will be very foolish for a bank or for insurance company will pay out at a relatively stable rate, but invest in products which are purely volatile. I don't think so. And then some of us will say, you know, put into insurance standards. Then I will want to say, you know, we will must refence by some ways. And for those products, it seems similarly provided by banks and insurance, not mingle with insurance products. And other features, I don't think it is appropriate just to say for insurance, if insurance provides such kind of products, you should apply these standards at all. I don't think it is appropriate.
Philippe, and then I would like to pass the water.
I find it a bit odd that we have to decide on the applicability and which standard applies before we have defined what is the instrument, which is paper 14C. Now we're discussing 14B, where to apply it, but we have not yet agreed on the exact definition, which is discussion in 14C, where this addendum in italics that is discussed, and you say it should not be added, but it's not yet decided. And then, to me, if there was this addendum, and I think Jan made the point, it could help restrict the application to products issued by insurance companies. Okay? Maybe that definition or something a bit different. But we have to decide on the applicability even before we have agreed on how to define the product. I think it's not the right way to do it.
I did struggle with how to break up these papers.
Sorry, you said that.
I did struggle with how to break up these papers because similarly, you couldn't make a decision on the definition before having decided whether they were going to be in. But that's why I brought both papers together.
I would like to test the water about the staff recommendation as it is, so no, which is that it should be included, that financial instruments with discretionary participation features should be included within the scope of the insurance contract standards without any further ring fencing requirements. Who could support that?
I support the staff recommendation.
Seven.
So I suppose then the second question would be if we were to limit this possibility to the insurance industry, how many of us could support this decision?
10.
Pat?
I would prefer not, but I you know, I wouldn't dissent over it.
Okay. 10.
Did you have your hand up?
Yeah,
12.
12.
Okay.
10.5. 11.5.
Further narrow down the products or any product issued by insurance company you were subject to?
Yes. This proposal is formulated by the staff.
Well, I think there are two alternatives. One is to stick with something like the ED definition, which automatically ring-fences it to insurance companies. And if you don't want to do that, then I think something else, which would be defining these contracts issued by insurers or by bodies that predominantly issue insurance contracts or something of that kind. So I think the next step is to look at the definition first and see whether you want to keep the clause that was in the ED or not.
You can come back on that.
So you would have to come back.
It's in 14C. It's the italics in 14C.
Shall we go to 14C then?
It's the italics bit in 14C.
Joan?
Paper 14C discusses the definition, which the definition proposed in the exposure draft is in page two of paper 14C. And the definition is the same as that in IFRS 4, except with the addition of that clause in italics at the end that says, provided there also exist insurance contracts that provide similar contractual rights to participate in the performance of the same pool of assets. That would definitely have restricted the definition to insurers, but it would restrict it further than just to insurers. It would restrict it to insurers that also issue insurance contracts that are sharing in the performance of the same pool of assets as the DPF contracts. And what we discussed in this paper, the definition, that clause was added to the definition for the exposure draft, really for three reasons. One was because on the understanding that these things always share in the same pool of the performance of the same pool of assets, thought that it would just help allay concerns that the definition could be applied too widely, and also increase the reasons for treating them in the same way as insurance contracts. But it was done on the understanding that these contracts, the DPFs issued by insurers, always share in the performance of the same pool of assets as insurance contracts. And the feedback we got was that this isn't, in fact, the case. In some jurisdictions, the regulator requires them to be split. In others, they require them to be split in some circumstances. And in others, the insurer can just choose whether to pool them with insurance contracts or not. And so the concerns that came back from respondents was that we wouldn't be meeting the objective of including these things in the insurance contract standard if we then scoped some of them back out again. And that if we did, we would be scoping them in or out on a fairly arbitrary basis, and one that was open to manipulation. One thing that I should point out was that some of the respondents who said that this clause was going to be a problem suggested other ways of limiting the definition, and they're in paragraph 15. So these are also ones that you might like to consider. They said you could restrict it to contracts that are issued by insurers or managed alongside insurance contracts. So they wouldn't have to share in the same pool of assets, but they would have to be issued by entities issuing similar contracts that are insurance contracts. Probably B is a tougher clause than A, but neither is as restrictive as C, as the exposure draft proposal. Mm-hmm. A and B. Yep, you could. But the staff recommendation was to remove that additional criterion completely. But if you now wanted to restrict this to cut to the insurance industry, you would alternatively be able to replace it with a requirement that they're either issued by and or managed alongside insurance contracts, but we'd have to look further at making that work.
Would you have to bring back a paper for that?
I would like to, but I don't know.
Amaru?
I'm confused with your statement, final statement, because I voted before in support to restriction to IFA, to insurance companies. So
that's a given.
Yep.
But we have to define it.
It's two words to do it.
So then I just would like to understand, to be clear on your proposition. So it will be limited to insurance companies. And then?
Well, you would have different ways.
She's not answering. She's not answering.
Don't put out your mic, okay?
Okay, sorry. You would have different ways of limiting it to insurance companies, is all that I'm saying. And that you could limit it with that clause proposed in the exposure draft, which people told us was problematic.
Okay.
Or you could limit it by saying something like they've got to be issued by insurers.
By paragraph 15.
Paragraph 15.
So this is the easiest, simplest way to transmit our decision.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
This is my point.
Andrea?
I mean, I guess the main... John. I see what you're going to say. I guess the question really is, in the exposure draft, you proposed that it would be limited to
contracts which have shown in the same pool of assets of the profit and loss of the same company, entity or fund. And that's a lot narrower than just the vote to restrict it to insurance company. If you want to just restrict it to insurers, then that is wider, but it's not as wide as a staff recommendation. So if you want to go to that middle ground, that would be fine. You could vote that today and we could deal with that in the drafting.
Yeah, but I think the issue you have to deal with is the conglomerates. And there's one large European country, for example, where a lot of these things are issued, and there's at least one large bank insurer. So you'll have to decide whether you want them.
Philippe. As a conglomerate which has a bank and an insurance company, it's hard to say that the contract is not issued by an insurer.
Well, that's the issue we'd have to look at.
You have an insurer and a bank as a form of conglomerate. You cannot say it's a